Thank you, Ben, for giving us the post-coffee, pre-lunch slot, which guarantees that nobody can possibly fall asleep. And audience engagement will be at its maximum, so pressure off. This is going to be really easy, guys. No, I work for ESSA, which is a community of sponsors, rights holders, and agencies across Europe. And there's two things I want to say about that. One is to echo what Susan said this morning, that sponsorship is now a values-led discipline. And nothing really happens in sponsorship without a deeper sense of purpose and measurement. Secondly, nothing is done in this space in isolation. It's all about partnerships. And that's why we're talking this morning about partnerships, in particular around events. So we're going to look at how event partners use those relationships to drive change and react to change to ultimately give the best possible event experience for all stakeholders. I'd like to give the chance to each of our panelists to do a one-minute intro, just so you can be fully aware of what they do and what kind of events they are involved in. Jana, can you go first, please?
Is that on? I don't know. Yeah. So I'm Jana. I'm working for the Vienna Medical Academy, as the name says. We're based in Vienna, Austria. We're a professional congress organizer, so I'm coming from a slightly different perspective than probably most of you here. We're not focusing on sports, but we're focusing on medical congresses, medical meetings, and all that kind of stuff. And I'm the project lead for the Congress of Human Genetics, the European meeting, which takes place every once a year at the beginning of June. And we have about 3,500 to 4,000 delegates per event.
Thanks, Shara. Tim, next, please.
Okay, I'm Tim Briarcliffe from AIPH. That's the International Association of Horticultural Producers, which makes sense. The letters make sense if you say it in French. Our role is to approve international horticultural exhibitions. You'll be familiar with the World Expos, like as was in Expo 2020 Dubai, and they're governed by the international convention that formed the BIE, which is based in Paris. Well, within that same convention, there is a section which says that if a country wants to host an international horticultural exhibition and invite other countries to participate through diplomatic channels, they require first the approval of AIPH, which is where we come in. So if a country wants to host them, they come to us, and we will assess their application and see them through the process. These events are large events, typically more than 50 hectares, up to even 500 hectares was the one in Beijing in 2019. They're bringing in visitors of 2 or 3 million in Europe, up to 10 million we had in Beijing. And we've just had one close in Suncheon, in the bottom of South Korea. They told us that they were going for 8 million, and I didn't believe it, but they've just closed having received 9 million visitors through this exhibition. So countries come, and rather than creating just a big building, they're creating a garden, a horticultural experience. But with the emphasis on environmental challenges we're facing in the world, the need for greening in cities, the emphasis is the themes of these expos are all around greening, sustainability, and preparing for the future using the natural environment. And like any expo, they're entertaining, but they're also political. They are about business. They're about relations, international relations, and all these kind of things. Could talk for ages on it, but I just wanted to have a bit more time to introduce it, because I know the concept of it may be new to some of you, and we have more information on the table outside.
Thank you, Tim. Passing over to the boss of snooker, Jason.
Hi, I'm Jason Ferguson, so I'm chairman of the World Professional Snooker Association. I'm also a director of World Snooker, which is the actual company that owns the World Snooker Tour. We're a sport, global sport. We operate about 25 to 28 major events around the world in any season. Huge television output. We're not a mass participation sport like big venues and tens of thousands of people, but we are a mass participation sport in terms of our people that play around the world and participate. So television, very strong. Our UK championship will start on the BBC in the next few weeks. We just finished live on ITV last night. We're sending those TV pictures to around 150 countries. Next week, 190 countries with a TV reach of about 1.8 billion homes. So really a television product.
We also have a sponsor. This is Brett from NatWest Group.
That's half my introduction right there. So, Brett Williams, sponsorship lead for NatWest Group. For those outside the UK, we are one of the big five banks, but have a very vast history of using sponsorship through our marketing mix, and have sponsored arts, entertainments, and indeed horticulture and agriculture for a number of years throughout the UK.
So we a diverse panel, I'm sure you'll agree. We're going to kick off with Jana, a question to you, please, and anyone else can come in afterwards. Working together with event stakeholders, how can we create a better understanding to strengthen partnerships and be more reactive to change?
Yes, so I go for the first part of the question. I think, in my opinion, it's very important, and the key factor to success in partnerships and collaborations is communication. This seems to be the obvious, but lately I've made the experience that to some people, to some organizations, it's not. So, I believe communication has to be very open, very straightforward, and very transparent, both sides. So we as the organizer also have to communicate very clear and very properly to the host city or the venue in that case, and the other way around. So I think that's number one. Number two is it also helps me changing the perspective at a certain point, so trying to understand what is the need and what is the needs and wants of my partner. That creates a better understanding for both parties, if they understand where I come from, if I understand where they come from, and maybe if they have a problem, they should let me know. If there's an issue, if there's a decision-making process that takes longer, then let me know why this is the case, and that will help me understand how the other side is actually working. And number three is we always try to encourage having a partnership at really a partnership level, so rather having that instead of having a relationship between a client and a supplier, because that's what it is in the end. But if you try to work it on a partnership level where both are more or less equal, having the understanding of each other, that helps really to foster their relationship and to be in an actual partnership. And the second part of the question, what has changed, right? So I think during the pandemic, what we've experienced is all of us have suffered, obviously, because we couldn't hold any events or only be virtual. So everybody was trying to survive at a certain point from their point of view. And I think we need to get closer together again to find solutions and tackle the changes that are coming and look at this more together as a unit instead of us as the organizer looking at a certain thing and the host city looking at a certain thing. So there should always be that overall goal that we're serving to deliver the experience of the event to our customer. And this should be always the number one goal we're looking at. Even if you're an organizer, if you're a supplier, if you're the venue, if you're the host city, that should be your overall goal.
I know that your work is sometimes around one mega event per year, a big medical congress, but in Tim and Jason, in your case, you multiple city partners every year, multiple events around the world. I'd like to know how much knowledge transfer impacts on those partnerships.
Knowledge transfer is enormous, and I think Jana would really hit the point. Really, it's about an understanding of what's going on, understanding of each partner. You know, the word partnership means that everybody must be involved, everybody must benefit, it must work for all parties. Communication has to be the point, and that's where we can transfer our knowledge, of course, on what goes on. And we have to learn. We go to, in our sport, we go to many different countries, many different cities. Cultural, changes, huge, huge challenges at times logistically. And, those challenges have to be overcome by understanding and knowledge transfer.
How much does that happen with your partners on a rolling basis, Tim?
Yeah, I think it's really important, and the city obviously is our key partner, but the relationship is completely different between because their expectations and our their expectations of us may differ, and we have traditionally been quite hands-off in a way. The organisation of the event is left to the city, and we will give guidance. But there comes a point, I've been doing this for a few years, where it's not easy watching the same mistakes being made again and again. So the extent to which we get involved and try and facilitate that knowledge transfer is really important. So we try through conferences, through publications, through webinars, these kind of things to keep bringing the organisers together, past organisers. What did you learn? What could you do better? What could be different? And to try and see how much more we should be inserting ourselves as an improving body into the process to ensure that the quality is maintained and that our expectations are also achieved. But often the city may start by saying, yes, you know, it's fine, we know what we're doing, and you know already all the things will happen, and you don't want to just stand back and watch that, but it's how as an approving body we regulate that and move with that is something we're always learning all the time.
And for you, Brett, having sponsored a mega event like COP26 here in Glasgow, what learnings were you able to take from that and apply to the more perennial partnership events that you're involved in?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So we've got a history of sponsoring long-term partnerships across the UK, and primarily because that's where we see the long-term brand benefit, and actually the efficiencies through the partnership. So you know, you're spending year after year less and less on activation to get your brand out there and to get it well known. I think through COP26, the planning element was so fundamental because we'd not done it before. We didn't have a template to be able to roll off. And you know, through those long-term partnerships, you know the event organisers, you know the event space, you know the contacts, you know if the shit hits the fan and water comes streaming through your activation unit 12 hours before the event, you know who to go to. For COP26, we didn't have that because we didn't have that knowledge base. So I think the planning that goes into that is just so fundamental, you know, and tenfold on those year-on-year partnerships that sort of roll around. And I think the second real learning is about collaboration. So again, those long-term partnerships that you establish, you almost carve out your own niche. You carve out what you want to be known for, and each partner talks to each other but stays in their own swim lane, where for a one-off event, actually there's more ability to collaborate, particularly around COP26, because it was a purpose or values-led partnership. Everyone was fighting for environmental impact to lower environmental impact, and therefore that opened a door to be able to collaborate and talk to the other partners that were in the room. So I think they're the two learnings from sort of a one-off event into long-term is planning. You've got to be more detailed, and the second point, collaboration, just that opens the door a little bit for us, I think.
Okay. We're talking about reacting to change, and we've just come through the biggest change in the history of modern humanity, the pandemic. So the next question is really just about technology. And in the same way about understanding between partners and knowledge transfer, any of you want to go there in terms of what's changed since the pandemic in terms of technology and how that's enabled you to do a better job?
Yeah, I mean, technology, we just have to embrace it. Let's face it, the world is changing so fast. And, you know, we heard earlier, I think in Paul made in his opening address this morning about AI and the fears of what's coming. Look, it's coming. So we have to embrace technology. And a lot has changed, you know, in that period of time during the pandemic. We pre-pandemic, everybody met. During the pandemic, everybody still met, but met online. After the pandemic, we meet in person, which we prefer, by the way. But we still meet online, and we're cutting costs. We're looking at doing more things more efficiently. So technology has a huge part to play. But I think the most exciting thing, being in live sport and entertainment, or sportainment, I think was the buzzword of the day. Being in this business, the most exciting thing is we do not know what is coming next. It's exciting to think what we could embrace. What could live sporting events be like in another 10 years? They will be unrecognisable. We don't know it, but we have to embrace it.
Thanks, Jason. Anyone else want to talk about technology? Oh, we'll move on. Yeah, okay. Brett, question to you about purpose. From a sponsor's point of view, can you talk us through your transformation over the years to a more purpose-driven partnership model and in an events context?
Yeah, in sponsorship and events, I think, gone are the days where partnerships were sort of agreed to on a chairman's whim or a CEO's desires. There's a real sort of focus on purpose and values and how you align those and how you tell that narrative. And one thing I think we found, again, with a COP26 partnership, we used that as a platform to be able to launch a new purposeful narrative in 2018. So everything that we did as an organisation needed to align to either climate or learning or enterprise. And every single thing we did through the organisation needed to do that. But actually, as a bank, it's really difficult to land that with credibility and authority. So you've got to think about what you're trying to say and how you're trying to say it. And we really, with discussion around fossil fuel financing and those sorts of things, we had to take a bit of a hit and say, you know what, we'll put our hand up. This is the start of a journey. We're not there yet. And we made an open apology and said, we've got lessons to learn. But this is a line in the sand and this is how we can take it forward. I would say that's a lesson. You kind of need to be, you need to know your self-worth or self-value or where you sit in that spectrum before you can go out there to land it with authenticity. Because if you don't, it can go very, very wrong for you.
That is the key word, authenticity, and it seems like an apology is a pretty good way to start when you're trying to achieve that. Jana and Tim, you both have a clear purpose to promote medical advancements on your side and horticultural on your side, Tim. So looking at how you partner with host cities, what is the lasting local legacy of your events and how has this changed in recent years?
I can go first. So for our part, we can say that since we're the European meeting of human genetics, we were rotating around Europe to major cities, whatever, where the venue fits, where the accessibility is great. And I think that has changed now or is into transformation because we now experience that obviously it's difficult to start every time back from scratch. So what we've just touched on. Going to a new venue every year, working with different or new people every year. So why not build long-term relationships with those venues that work pretty well for our Congress? The people that we work with, easy to work with, everything is, just smooth. So I think that's been changed on our side. So we really want to look or focus on those venues and host cities where we had good experience, that we built long-lasting relationships with those. And let's say we pick like 3 or 4 for our Congress and then we rotate among those 3 and 4 cities and having maybe one spot open for other venues to come in. But that's what we're looking at and that has been changed during the last years. Yeah.
And for us, the legacy is critical, both for us and the city. And if you're doing a large scale event and you're creating something green, of course, it's an opportunity for city redevelopment. It's an opportunity to leave a green legacy for the city. And many hosts of an expo like this, it will kind of define that city for the future. So that it was the green expo city. And that becomes a way of attracting business and influence. The city in South Korea, they hosted it one also 10 years ago, and it's become like the green city of Korea, and now businesses are coming there because of that. So it attracts investment. You're creating a more livable city, We try to encourage activities that go out into the city, so it's not just restricted to the expo site itself. So there's the physical legacy that an expo like that leaves behind. But also we say that an expo should leave its mark on the world. And what are you leaving then that's a legacy that will change behaviour in the future? So we have an expo running in Doha at the moment, and they have over 70 countries participating there in Albida Park, right in the centre of Doha. And we'll be running a research symposium in February with a publication called Cities and Health. And the outcome of that will be a whole publication on how you can use nature and the environment to improve lives and health of people in cities. So these are the other kind of legacies that we want to see from our events as well as it really showcasing change. So countries are encouraged to demonstrate how to use nature and the environment and planting to tackle the challenges of climate change, to solve city problems. And in an expo, they can build stuff. They can show it as a real best practice way of doing it, which can then be used and taken on. So for me, the whole expo concept is about creating legacy, about producing something for the future.
How many people in the audience were at the Glasgow Garden Festival 25 years ago? Lots. I mean, that changed the city forever. It's possible if that hadn't, regeneration hadn't started then, we might not be here doing this conference today. Thanks, guys. Jason, your portfolio, your number of events has grown massively in recent years. And how have you been able to make sure that priorities are aligned within those multiple partnerships? And how does the event calendar work for all partners, including broadcasters?
Well, I mean, the event calendar, I mean, I don't even want to go there because, look, imagine if we all sat in here and said, let's put all our calendars on a pile in the floor and let's sort one calendar out. That's pretty much what our office does. That's not my job, by the way, thankfully, but our operations director seems to love it. So we'll leave it with him. But look, yeah, we've grown enormously. We, 13 years ago, we were 6 events, predominantly UK-based sport. We're now, you know, we've been up to 28 events in our best season, and we're heading that way very soon again. Some of those events are fixed, so some of that is regular. The World Championships at the Crucible Theatre is iconic for the sport. It's its home. A UK championship in York in the next few weeks. Some of these events stay. We own and operate these events, so we know what we're doing. We've been doing them a long time. But a lot of our events now are working with new countries, new partners, new promoters. And I think that's where, you know, it becomes very complicated. And the one thing I would say is you have to embrace local culture to begin with. Before you even step into anywhere, you cannot enforce your ways on this. I see sports doing this so many times around the world. They go in and say, you've got to do it this way. This is how you present our sport. No, you can present the sport, but embrace the local culture. Embrace the local surroundings. I like what Tim does. It's great. Funny enough, we had some crossover. We did an event in Beijing. Turned out it was Tim's event. We found out today. We had a small area called the English Garden. It had snooker tables with green bays on it. We're very green. We can do green. And you know the reason billiard cloth is green is because actually it used to be played on the lawn outside the old country houses. They moved it indoors because it's already always raining in the UK. But you know, there's so much crossover with local culture and things. And it's those challenges operationally, I think, that can become really difficult. What's it about? It's about trusted partners and making sure each partner gets what they need. You know, sponsors need one thing. The city wants to showcase to the world. The player just wants to take the prize money and the trophy and go home. There are so many conflicts in this. And that's really why you have this multi-structure environment. We're a multi-structure. We have a governing section doing all the governance. We've got a commercial operation doing commercials. We've got a player representation body. And all of it has to communicate. And I'll be honest, it has to communicate better. It's not a perfect world. But we are battling away and working on it, and it seems to be working.
I'm going to put the same question to Brett as one of those partners where the priorities need to be aligned. How has your experience changed as a sponsor in terms of how activation takes place?
Yeah, I think it's been an interesting time. Starting at the start, and this will probably be the dullest answer to a question today, the contracting part of it, like years ago you wouldn't have thought of a force majeure clause in a contract, but now you have to think about what if the event doesn't go ahead, what if it does go ahead but in a different place, what if it is postponed, what if it's then put virtual, and you have to think of a scenario plan for all of those and how you are going to draw value from that partnership, you know, through the rights that you get. So rights holders and partners have to be completely flexible. But Jason alluded to it, that the crux of that is the relationship. And that's the thing that is so fundamentally important, is having an open relationship so that it's not, you know, so hard and fast, because that's going to annoy both parties, and ultimately you're going to get a substandard result out of the end of it. So I think that relationship bit is just so fundamentally important, and it's been exacerbated or highlighted, I guess, by the likes of COVID in recent times, where relationships are more important than they ever were.
Since the pandemic, we've got three types of event, right? We've got online events, we've got in-person events, and we've got hybrids. I'm going to ask you, Tim and Jana, to talk us through your own perspective on that. So, Tim, for you, your expos are physical experience, right? And how do you work with your cities to protect that model, assuming it's quite integral to revenue?
Yes. For the expo concept to work for horticulture, you have to come in person. Yes, it's very difficult to replicate it online. The city of Yanzhou in China managed to run one of our expos in 2021. And they did that, but it was a shorter, and they did some of it online and so on. But, you know, that's difficult. Yes, really, to come, you need to come and you need to experience that. And one of the things we want to show through these expos is to come and experience plants and the natural environment in a different way. So you have to provide those experiences that make people come. You have to provide something which gives them a new and novel way of interaction. But there is a curiosity about sustainability and all these kind of things, but also that can be perceived as a bit boring as well, yes, if for a visitor attraction point of view. So you need to make it, bring it alive. How can plants and green affect your lives? What can you go home and do? What will it be that someone will then come to the expo, visit, and say to someone else, you've got to go back and see it? You've got to have that compelling reason. So Doha's a good example of one where being a small population, they're going to rely on quite a lot of repeat visits over 6 months. So they've got to keep having new content that is coming in and being introduced throughout the exhibition to keep people coming back. But there can be technology on the show there, but unless you have people coming in an expo and experiencing it, then it doesn't work. So that really has to be a focus for us.
And for you, Jana, the conference in Berlin next year, for example, will be hybrid, right? So can you talk us through why you've stuck with that model and how it works?
Yes, so our journey has been a little bit different. Obviously, in 2020 and 2021, we were completely virtual. And then for 22, we decided to actually become hybrid, which means on 4 conference days, live streaming over 100 sessions. So that's quite a bit. Also taking that point of view from a production side or from a budget point, organizational-wise. So that's obviously basically more or less like organizing a second event in parallel. The model we had in 2022 was actually that the participants could register for one fee, and we gave them the maximum of flexibility, which was very much appreciated at that point. So that means they could decide up to the day of the first day of the conference if they want to join virtual or if they want to be on site. So we're in the lucky position that the human genetics community really wants to be on site, wants to meet each other, because that's basically, you know, that meeting where everybody meets everybody. So we're not experiencing too much of a shift from people coming on site to online. And that's why we take that approach, or the different approach, saying we want to stay hybrid at least for another more year, but we're constantly evaluating if that's still the way to go, if that's still what the people want, if that's still, yeah, what the people need. But we're trying to include the broader audience while offering the Congress online, because there are a lot of people that can't travel because they either have travel restrictions, they have visa restrictions, they cannot afford to come to the conference, so they would not come either way. But by making it hybrid, we actually have the possibility to include them for a lower fee, obviously, now, to still take part in the Congress.
Okay, before we open up to the floor, one quick question for all of you. Looking back over the years, which event partnership has changed the way you operate most? Brett?
Can I go with two? I'll make it quick. I think number one was our partnership with English Cricket Board. So we had a partnership with them for 42 years. And whilst that doesn't sound transformational in itself, the fact that it had that longevity and we changed and evolved the partnership over and over and over again and ran a different campaign every 1 to 2 years means that it was genuinely transformational, and that's one of the benefits of sponsorship, is that it's so malleable, it's so flexible for rights holders and sponsors. And the second one, we've just signed a partnership with Team GB, and it's been absolutely brilliant in the last 10 months, just working with them from a relationship point of view. But actually, the whole business has embraced it because there's such love for the organisation. Everything you see with a NatWest logo on it this year will have some relationship with Team GB. And it's just been embraced by the whole organisation, which is fundamentally a first for us in the last 30-odd years.
Jason, please.
Yeah, thank you. I think the one thing I would start with is never underestimate what a partner can do for you. And I'll tell a story. I remember somebody in our office saying, "Oh, listen, that's just the table manufacturer. Billiard tables. We need billiard tables for our sport. Just the table manufacturer." The table manufacturer turned out to be also a real estate developer and various other business in Asia. And over the last 13 years, that table manufacturer that we were paying initially for a service has now become a promoter of 2 major events for us across China, and also has become the founder of the first billiard sports city in the world. A city of 4 million people in China, Yushan. Coming from sport, we like the little guy that wants to be the big guy, and all, we love the story. So a very small city, which was tier 5, tier 1 would be Beijing, Shanghai, tier 5, a very lower level city in terms of infrastructure, embraced our sport through an event that we did together with our partner. And what's led on from that is a new stadium. It's a 4,000-seat arena designed around our sport. We have a whole training academy there for Q Sports now. It's a whole campus, including student accommodation, athletes' village. And in March, we're going back to open the International Museum there. And now this small city, in our sport, of course, is now known as a little bit of a centre in the world. So I think that, when we talk about transformational partnerships, that's something that somebody had disregarded in those early days and has actually become, a real cornerstone of our sport in Asia.
Lovely story. Go on, Tim. See if you can beat that.
No, I can't beat that. I think it's interesting that the things that you change, often they come from us, because maybe it's come from partnerships that didn't work. Yeah? The things that you learn from the negative rather than the positive, and then you can make a change. But if I think of where it really is essential, our work in China, we couldn't do it without the involvement of our member, the China Flower Association. So we are also an association, and our members are organisations that represent the horticulture sector in that country. And that on-the-ground relationship is so critical for us to join the dots, to put us straight when we're making cultural mistakes, yes, or whatever. And they are really our face on the ground. So I think really having that strong relationship with our member, to build that, have that local relationship as well with the organizer, has been critical for us too.
Okay, Jana, please.
Yeah, I also don't have a specific example or story to tell, but I just think for us, as I mentioned before, we just want to focus on the relationship that are working well and embrace those more into a long-term relationship than rather than hopping to every new venue every year.
Super, okay. Ben, floor, shall we? Any questions from the floor, please? Well, we're 1 minute early. Ben. Okay. If I ask one, it'll end up being 10 minutes, so you'll be late. Well, one last question about technology then. Crystal ball time, AI, what's it going to change? Is it just going to make it easier or a lot harder?
Well, I guess we all don't know where this is going. So I think it's not AI that will be replacing us as we do the work that we do. I think it's more that every one of us has to, as we already said, has to get acquainted with that. And if you don't, then you'll be probably be the one replaced by the people that do. So I think it's not AI replacing us, but rather other people that can handle that.
I just make a comment on AI because... in our sector, you know, it's almost like the opposite of that. Yes, we're trying to get people away from technology to come and experience nature and environment. But I do use it sometimes. I for a long time, writing the speeches for our president when he stands at the opening ceremonies and this kind of thing. And a recent one we had in Qatar, I thought, well, let's have a play with this, you know, ChatGPT. And so I had a go and put some aspects of that, which ChatGPT came into the speech. And then as our president was speaking, and then there was going to be another, the Secretary General of BIE and an Emir of Qatar. And so I suddenly thought, well, I had this real streak of panic. Like, what if they also used it? What if the line I put in is, that, which I thought was a really good one there, is also someone else is going to come up with. And so anyway, it just gave me a bit of panic. I thought, actually, I'm not going to ever use that again. They didn't, thankfully.
I'll jump in just to expand on a point there. I think one thing that's really interesting in the world of sponsorship is it felt like about 4 or 5 years ago, everyone was involved in establishing and building really immersive, really deep engagement with client bases and audiences and stuff. Excuse me. And then there's a little bit of a shift into Instagram and TikTok and Snap came along, and all of a sudden it was all content driven. So partners were gravitating towards reach as opposed to depth of engagement, and it's not what I think will happen, but it's what I'd love to happen, is almost to go back a step and start to create that depth of engagement that you get at events and in person, and sort of touching and feeling things a little bit more than just it's going to turn up as a meme on my Snapchat and, you know, I'm going to disregard it in the next 24 hours.
I think that's been a big learn for me, so thanks everyone for the panel. Anyone who wants to talk to me while I'm here just about partnerships and how you can do anything better, I'm sure we can help at ESSA. So without further ado, just a big round of applause for the panel, please.